The Guardian.
Good evening and welcome to King's Place in London. I'm Jude Brown, the Director of the University of Cambridge Centre for Gender Studies, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the second of our three dialogues between leading international experts and the public on gender and the biomedical advances of the 21st century. This is an event which is a collaboration between the University of Cambridge Centre for Gender Studies and the Guardian newspaper and is kindly supported by Cambridge University Press. Well, there's sometimes a tendency to cast questions of gender solely in scientific terms or in social terms, which highlights the seeming lack of fit between the natural sciences on the one hand and the social sciences and humanities on the other. But our starting position is somewhat different. Social, political, and cultural debates that we have about gender must be informed by cutting-edge scientific research, and at the same time, scientific methods and results should always be subject to consistent critical analyses rooted in social context. So, bearing that in mind, tonight's topic is what can science tell us about gendered behaviour? And in a moment, I'll pass you to our chair for this evening. But the format will be that each speaker will speak on their various perspectives on tonight's topic. And this will be followed by an open dialogue between you, the audience, and them. And please do take that opportunity to direct your questions to the panel. So tonight's chair is Madeleine Bunting, who's a columnist and associate editor at The Guardian. She writes on a wide range of subjects, including science and ethics, Islam, gender and politics, and she's a regular broadcaster and award-winning author of several books, most recently The Plot, which is shortlisted for the Royal Society of Literature's Odanchi Prize. So please do join me in welcoming her as chair.
Thank you very much, Jude. I'm delighted that this panel has gathered here today. It's a remarkable group of people whose work has fascinated me for a very long time. I think we're hugely privileged to be able to participate in a conversation with all of them. I'm going to introduce all of the panel, and then they'll speak, and then you'll get your chance to put some questions to them. So as they speak, do make notes or keep in your mind what key points you want to raise with them. On my far left is Simon Baron Cohen. He probably needs no great introduction. He's the Professor of Developmental Psychopathology in the Department of Psychiatry and Experimental Psychology at Cambridge. He's a leading figure in the study of autism, which he considers to be a condition of the extreme of the male-type brain. And his controversial book, The Essential Difference, sets out his new theory on how, on average, men and women have subtly different patterns of interests from birth. On my immediate left is Elizabeth Spelker, who is a professor of cognitive psychology at Harvard University, and her research over many years has focused on the nature and development of knowledge, and she rejects the view that men and women have cognitively different abilities. On my right is Professor Robin Dunbar, who is a professor of evolutionary anthropology at Oxford, and his research focuses on the cognitive and neural underpinnings of social behaviour and social and reproductive decision-making, evolution of sociality in both human and primate societies. And on my far right is Deborah Cameron, who's the Rupert Murdoch Professor of Language and Communication at Oxford. And Cameron's work is principally focused on gender and language, and she is critical of the dominant discourses within the fields of evolutionary and experimental psychology, which describe men and women as having innate differences in their use of language. So we have a remarkable range of disciplines and viewpoints, and I'm delighted to ask Professor Baron Cohen to start us off.
Thank you very much. Well, good evening, everybody. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm going to start with the very basic question. You can see on this slide, do males and females differ? And it should be a very straightforward question when we're thinking about the body, the physical body. You can see for yourselves where the differences lie. But on the left of that slide, you can also see the Y chromosome, because that really ultimately separates males from females. Males have a Y chromosome and females don't. And at the top of the Y chromosome is a gene called the SRY gene, which simply tells the fetus whether to become male or female. So the presence of that gene determines whether the fetus grows testes and subsequently the testes producing testosterone, the sex hormone, which can influence the body. And the question tonight is whether it can also influence the brain and behaviour. So we all know that males and females differ in the body. There's a long list of characteristics here that you can see that differ between males and females, and I've just simply shown one in large, which is the size of the pelvis, because you can see that the female pelvis down below here is much wider than the male pelvis, presumably for reasons to do with genetics and hormones, creating that difference, because females have to ultimately bear children. So we also know that there are sex differences in other physical characteristics, height and weight principally being the most visible of these, that males weigh more than females on average, so 15% difference, and in terms of height, on average, males are 6 inches larger than females. We're just talking about averages. You can always find individuals who are typical or atypical for their sex. So the real question is, why should the brain be any different to the rest of the body? Why should it be immune to the effects of biology in terms of sex differences? What we see here is that there are indeed clear sex differences in the size of the brain right from infancy. In fact, the youngest infants that have been measured using MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, to look at total brain volume are as young as 2 weeks old, and we see a clear difference. It's about 8% difference in total brain volume. But the interesting thing on this slide is not about the total size of the brain, which I think is probably irrelevant. It's more about the rate of development, because what we see is that girls are developing faster in terms of their overall rate of development. This is total brain volume, girls in red, boys in blue. And what you see is that girls reach their maximum or their peak much earlier than boys. For girls, it's about 10 years old. For boys, it's about 15 years old. So there's a dramatic difference in the rate of growth of the brain. Now, interestingly, the brain can be divided into white and grey matter. Most of you will have heard of this. The white matter of the brain being what's myelinated, so it's where the nerve cells have an insulation called myelin. And we also see sex differences in the way that the white and grey matter develops. Again, girls reaching their peak at an earlier age than boys. So what we're seeing, if you just pick out where those arrows are, is that girls are developing faster. Let's leave aside total brain volume, that they're reaching their peak faster in terms of the number of years, and that males are taking longer, they have a steeper curve in the growth of both white and grey matter. We see this even when we look lobe by lobe. So in the frontal lobe or the temporal lobe, girls are just getting there faster. And this has, I think, big implications for education. It has implications for how we think about development, that there are differences in the rate of maturation. We can turn aside from looking at total brain volume or even regions of the brain to look at functions of the brain, because here we can now look at which parts of the brain show sex differences in size to do with particular functions. This is the language centre, Wernicke's area, sometimes also called Heschel's gyrus or planum temporale, and that's larger in females than males. And here's a different structure, the amygdala, which is larger in males than females. And the amygdala is involved in emotion processing. So we can pinpoint sex differences to do with function and structure. This is an MRI scan where the person is asked to do a task whilst they're lying in the scanner, so we can look more closely at the amygdala whilst it's at work. So in this study, people are asked to look at emotional imagery and later remember what they saw. What we see is that the amygdala picked out on the left and the right shows a different pattern of activity in men and women as related to what they remember about emotional stimuli. There are also a range of other sex differences in the brain. This is to do with neurochemistry, that males produce 50% more serotonin, the neurotransmitter, than females. And we've been looking at the role of prenatal testosterone. So here we've been asking women who have amniocentesis during pregnancy, where a needle is introduced into the amniotic fluid surrounding the fetus, whether we can have their consent to measure the amount of testosterone produced by the fetus. Males and females produce this hormone, but males produce twice as much as females. And we then wait till the baby's born to see if there's any relationship between the level of prenatal testosterone and how the child turns out. What you can see is that there's an inverse correlation. That's to say, the higher the child's prenatal testosterone, the slower they are to develop language at 1 year of age. And we've also found similar patterns with eye contact, that the higher the child's fetal testosterone, the less eye contact they make at 1 and 2 years of age. And even later, as we follow them up in development, in terms of their empathy. But equally, we've also found that this same hormone, fetal testosterone, is positively correlated with the number of autistic traits a person shows. This is not the same as diagnosable autism. It's simply characteristics related to autism. And what we see is that the higher the child's fetal testosterone, the more autistic traits the child is showing at the age of 8. So the last part, which was briefly mentioned, is that I've been interested in the relationship between autism, the neurodevelopmental condition, and typical sex differences, asking the question, is autism an extreme of the male brain? And what we see is that in areas of behaviour, or indeed the brain, where girls are developing faster than boys, people with autism are showing even slower development. That's true of language, it's true of social development, and it's true of that language area in the brain, Heschel's gyrus. In contrast, in areas of the brain where boys are developing faster than girls, people with autism show even faster development. That's true of overall brain volume, that children with autism seem to have an early overgrowth of the brain. It's true of the amygdala that we mentioned earlier, and it's also true of what's called systemizing, or a fascination with how systems work. So I'm going to conclude, to stay within my 8 minutes, to say that I think there are sex differences on average in the brain, that's to say in the biology of the brain, but I think that biology and social experience come together, they interact to produce what we see in postnatal life. The third point I want to make is that when scientists look at gender or at sex differences, I think that can be a valid enterprise that's independent of our political aspirations. So we may, for example, aspire to a society which is based on equality and which is free of discrimination, but all the while be free as scientists to ask the question, are there sex differences? And finally, just the final point here is that there's a worry that scientific approaches to sex differences will lead to stereotyping, will lead to discrimination. And I want to argue that good science, which is evidence-based, does not lead to the conclusion that all males show one pattern and all females show another. Rather, all it shows is that when you compare groups, males and females, you see average differences, and that individuals may be atypical for their sex. Thank you.
Many thanks, Simon. That's remarkable timekeeping. Congratulations. I'm going to ask Liz now, and in the course of her presentation, she's going to particularly answer the question, do males and females have different aptitudes for certain cognitive skills, such as, for example, maths?
Okay, thank you, Madeline. And thank you, Jude, and all the organizers. I'm really happy to be here. I'd actually like to start by echoing one thing that Simon just said. I think in considering the question whether men's and women's brains are different, the equally charged question that I want to take on of is there a biological basis to our higher reasoning abilities, and if so, could it be that some groups of people would be less well endowed than other groups of people with the basic aptitude to develop those abilities? I think these are questions that science needs to be free to answer and that we shouldn't be afraid of. I think if it were to turn out that the answer to either of those questions were yes, and that abilities were to divide up along gender lines, that we should think about that kind of answer the way we would think about findings that say some groups of people are more susceptible to develop some kind of cancer or other disease, that this is important information that society can use to achieve whatever social goals democratic societies agree on. We shouldn't be afraid of the findings of science. That said, my answer to Madeline's question, are there biologically based cognitive differences in the aptitudes for reasoning about mathematics and science that fall along gender lines, is going to be no. I don't see any such evidence for them. I think such differences could exist, but as I look at the evidence, I don't see them. But in order to make that point, I need to back up. And in fact, I'm going to spend most of my time backing up and asking a prior question. What is our biologically based aptitude for reasoning about the physical world, about the abstract world of number and geometry, about all the domains that come together to make possible human accomplishments in technology and science and mathematics? Now, I think the answer to this question is not obvious, because most of the activities that we really care about in science and mathematics are very recent accomplishments when you measure human accomplishments over the time scale of human evolution. We haven't been doing these things for very long. And so I think it's very unlikely that we've been shaped through natural selection to learn calculus or molecular biology, or even probably to learn the kind of mathematics that children learn in school. If that's right, then what we must do when we reason about science and mathematics as adults, and what children must do when they learn it, is take cognitive capacities that evolved for other purposes to accomplish other tasks and harness them for this new purpose. So if we're going to ask what our capacities are for scientific and mathematical reasoning, we have to ask, what are these foundational capacities that get harnessed when we learn and practice science and mathematics? And now that's the question that's really been at the center of my work. I don't actually study sex differences in cognition directly, but I do care about these cognitive precursors to higher level human reasoning. And my work, together with the work of many other people in developmental psychology, in cognitive psychology, and cognitive neuroscience, I think provides evidence for five foundational systems, at least, that come together to allow us to reason in these domains. And let me quickly lay them out. One is a system for representing and reasoning about physical objects and their mechanical interactions. It's a system that allows us to single objects out when they appear, make predictions about how they're going to move, develop expectations about what will happen if two such objects collide, and so forth. Two more systems are systems for reasoning about space and relationships in geometry. One focuses on the geometrical properties of small-scale visual forms and serves to allow us to recognize and categorize particular types of objects. By doing geometrical analyses, we can distinguish a fork from a spoon, for example, or any other types of artifacts that we encounter. The other geometrical system focuses on the shape of the large-scale spatial layout, and we use it to maintain our sense of where we are in space and where other significant places are and how we can navigate from one to another. And finally, there are two systems at the center of our reasoning about number. One, a system for representing small, exact numbers, the difference between 1 and 2 and 3. And the other, a system for representing large, approximate numerical magnitudes, the difference between 10 and 20. And the second system in particular can be used not only to estimate number approximately, but also to do approximate arithmetic operations. So, for example, shown an array of 10 dots joined by an array of 10 more dots, we can represent without counting that there are approximately 20 dots in that display. Now, all five of these abilities arise in human infancy. We get evidence for all of them when we present tasks requiring spatial analysis or numerical analysis or analysis of the motions of physical objects to infants. All five of these abilities also persist over the course of childhood, continue to exist in us as adults, and they serve as a basis for children learning new skills in school and for us performing those skills as adults. And because time is short, I want to give just one example, and I'll use the last system I talked about, the system of approximate number representation. So, as I said, we can add two numbers together approximately without counting, and so can young infants. So if an infant is shown an array of dots that goes behind a screen, and then a second array of dots goes behind the screen, if there were 10 dots in each array, the infant will spontaneously represent that there's approximately 20 dots behind that screen. And if when you remove the screen you show many too few dots, say 10, or way too many, say 40, the infant will look longer at that display. They'll do a double take. On the other hand, this ability is approximate because if you've presented 10 plus 10 and then show 18 or 22, the infant will be perfectly happy with that. They're only capable of approximate addition and approximate numerical representation. Well, children retain this ability as they get ready to go to school. And if you present 5-year-old children with these kinds of approximate arithmetic tasks, you find two things. First of all, their numerical abilities have sharpened relative to the infant. So a 5-year-old might be able to tell you that approximately 10 plus approximately 10 is more than 15 and less than 25 or 27. They've sharpened relative to the infant, but still the ability is approximate. And what I just gave you was a characterization of average performance, but actually there's a range of performance on tasks like this, and it predicts children's subsequent learning of symbolic arithmetic. If you assess children's ability to do these non-symbolic tasks just as they start school, and then ask at the end of school, who's learned the most math over the course of the year, you find a relationship between the two. So this is the kind of evidence that leads me to conclude that this system and the other four systems all are tapping biologically based aptitude for reasoning in these domains. So finally, to Madeline's question, are there sex differences in any of these abilities? Well, I've given you a very long detour, but I'm going to give you a very short answer to that question, not that we can find. We've looked at, we've compared male and female infants, male and female young children. We see no sex differences on average in tasks tapping any of these five systems. What's more, we've looked at variability and asked, what happens, for example, if we just look at the best children, the ones who perform the best on the math tasks or the spatial tasks? Do we see more males than females in that upper group? Again, the answer is no. We see equal numbers of males and females in the two groups. And I think most importantly, our reason for doing all of these studies is not just to ask, can an infant or a child do such and such a task, but how do they do them? What underlying processes do they use? And we can get at this by looking at brain function, by looking at how behavioral abilities are modulated when you change the task a little bit here or there or present different displays. And on that basis, we learn something about the underlying processes. We can ask, are there any differences in the underlying processes by which girls reason about number and by which boys do? And again, the evidence suggests no. The same factors that make it a little easier or a little harder for a boy to succeed at one of these addition tasks, for example, will have a similar effect on girls. So my conclusion is that males and females show highly convergent capacities for reasoning about mathematics and science. And I think in some ways that's a surprising conclusion. I think it's surprising in light of all of the phenomena that Simon described. Of course, men and women, boys and girls, differ physically. We differ hormonally. We also differ in lots of other ways. We tend in societies around the world to have different roles, to show different kinds of social reactions and so forth. Yet when we look at our core cognitive capacities, I think we see this enormous convergence. And one question I'd love to see later discussion on is why that might be. A second reason I think this work is surprising is that I think it feels intuitively right to us to think that there might be some intrinsic differences between the ways that men think and the ways that women think. I'm probably out of time, right?
I think you've got about one or two more minutes.
If I have one or two more minutes, I'd like to shift and make just one small suggestion about why I think it might be that we're so perpetually fascinated by this idea of gender differences in our cognitive abilities, even when research such as that I described suggests that, in fact, those differences are not real. And this work, the work I've talked about so far comes from looking at very young children's cold cognitive abilities. They're reasoning about objects, about space, about number. But there's lots of research also looking at young children's social cognitive abilities. And what we and many other people find is that essentially from the beginning of life, infants are learning to navigate their social world and picking up on a variety of different sorts of social information. They distinguish when people are attentive to them versus not. They distinguish among different people based on their social group, for example, interacting preferentially with people who speak to them with their own native accent relative to a foreign accent. And also very early, infants distinguish between other people by gender. Now, this distinction influences young children's decisions about, say, which object to play with, even when they're presented with a choice for which research shows no gender difference. If we introduce a three-year-old child to two new objects and say, this child, and pictures of two children, one of each sex, and say, this child over here likes one this object and the other child likes the other object, which one would you like to play with? Even though the child's going to be playing alone, they will tend to choose the object that was associated with the child of their own gender. I think what this may be reflecting is a very deep-rooted tendency in us to think that gender matters and to interpret small differences that we see as reflecting large underlying essential differences, if I can borrow a term. My bet is that that tendency is mistaken. And that as science continues to forge into this direction, it'll continue to surprise us by showing us how similar, in fact, males and females are.
Great, thank you. Robin, the question for you is, to what extent is gender human?
Okay, I'm really going to talk about your social lives, subject that's very dear to us all, I guess, because we live in it. We live in a very intensely social world, and that's partly because we're primates. And actually, I'm going to take the pitch, really, that our kind of sociality is a rather generic kind of primate sociality. So in that sense, this kind of discussion really is not peculiar to humans in a way. It is much broader. It applies more generally to monkeys and apes. And that within that, probably for all monkeys and apes and us, there are surprisingly radical differences in the social worlds the two sexes live in. So let me just think about monkeys and for a moment and just sort of contemplate the social life of juveniles. Most of it's spent engaged in a lot of play. Typically, you'll find males and females, infants and juveniles, will get together and start playing. Sooner or later, needless to say, the boys start getting rough and the girls wander off and do something more interesting and the boys get on with the rough stuff. It's kind of what you see, I guess, in humans in many ways. But it kind of underlines the fact that really the girls' social world there is much more intensely social, literally social, than the boys. The boys' world is really one of display and dominance and this kind of stuff, whereas the girls are really networking in many in a really serious sort of sense. And indeed, the whole of primate sociality is female sociality. The males are almost bees round the honeypot, as it were. But if you look at the number of males in primate social groups, it's driven almost entirely by the dispersion of females. And it's the females that basically decide how big a group should be, what kind of structure it should have, because of their principal interests. And those interests are largely being driven by their reproductive interests. Reproduction is very costly for female mammals. It's one of the things we're kind of saddled with, I guess. So it's possibly no surprise to find that where you get your brain from rather depends on who you are and what you want to do with it. You probably think you get your brain half from your mother and half from your father. And the answer is no. You get the smart end of the brain, the neocortex, from one parent. Then you get the emotional end of the brain, Simon alluded to it, the amygdala and the limbic system there, from the other parent. Now, I wonder which parent you think you get which from. Aristotle had it right, which just shows we haven't learned anything in science since 350 BC. He said males are very emotional creatures and girls are much more calculating and so on. And this turns out to be right. So genomic imprinting, where you've got sort of accidents of genetic structure, where you do or you don't have the Y chromosome or the X chromosome to pass on, has shown that in mammals in general, it seems, you get the smart end of your brain, the neocortex, from your mum, and you get the emotional end of your brain, the limbic system, from your dad. And in one sense, that kind of makes sense, because given that the social world you live in, really it's the female interest. So what's happening in this context, I should have explained, is that one of the chromosomes know where they come from, in some sense, and the genes on the chromosomes, in very lay terms, know where they come from, and get silenced. So that only one set of chromosomes, or one set of genes, gets expressed. And it's the genes that determine neocortex growth that come from your mother that are the ones that get expressed. The ones that come from your father aren't. And vice versa, the genes that determine limbic system size. And you can show in primates that the size of limbic system is predicted much more by the number of males in the group across primate species, and the size of neocortex is predicted much better by the number of females in the group. And it kind of makes sense, because in mammalian mating systems, they're largely, you know, sort of males slugging it out like red deer males famously do. In order to be able to mate with females. And the last thing you want in evolutionary terms is a male to sort of face up to another male over a girl and say, oh, after you, help yourself. This is not a strategy. So what you want is the red mist to rise, no thought involved, just get in there and slug it out. You don't want that in females, of course, because it's very disruptive for the social system. So that's the sort of primate world, and in many ways we are primates, so we reflect a lot of those kind of things. So I just want to say a little bit off the back of that about some of the work we've been doing on social network size and the underpinnings of that. You have a limited number of people that you know as a serious acquaintance or friend, as it were. Apparently it's about 150, give or take a bit. And that number consists of a whole series of layers coming in towards you. And the innermost layer is about 5 intimate friends, and there's a layer outside that and another layer outside that, and eventually you get to 150. Every single sample we've looked at, with one exception, which was a slightly odd one because it was students, girls have much bigger social networks than boys. And Facebook have found the same thing. They did a complete trawl of all 44 million Facebook users earlier in the year to see whether people really did have more than 150 friends or not. The answer is they don't. Typically, the average is about 120 to 130. But again, they found that typically girls had slightly bigger, not a hugely bigger number of friends and acquaintances and so on than boys did. But it's enough to be significant. Again, the kind of differences that Simon was alluding to earlier, difference in the means, a lot of overlap. The number of friends you can hold, and particularly the inner core, which are probably the critical ones, is dependent both on the time you spend engaged with them, the time you spend making that friendship work, as it were, but also on certain key social cognitive skills. And the classic component to that is what's called theory of mind, or mentalizing. It's your ability to understand somebody else's mind states. Well, you can handle several different mind states simultaneously in a conversation, as it were. You know, I can wonder what Madeline is thinking. Liz is wondering that whether Simon is pondering something else. A chain of things. It turns out the girls are much better at doing those kind of tasks than boys are, consistently, again, in lots and lots of samples that we had. So the machinery, as it were, underpinning relationships for the two sexes is significantly different in that sense. Girls are just better at those kind of tasks. But there's another important respect in which it's not just your kind of mental processing, the size of your brain that determines your relationships, but also the time you invest in them. And we found very striking differences in how relationships are maintained between the two sexes. This was part of a longitudinal 18-month study of essentially use of mobile phone technology. That was the excuse for it. But really, we were interested in the relationships of our subjects. It turns out that if you move away from home, as many of us these days do, you don't have time to invest in your old friends, and those friendships decline rather quickly. It doesn't happen to kinship. Relationships remain incredibly stable over time, but friendship relationships are very fragile and deteriorate very quickly. If you look at what it is over the long term, as it were, a year to 18 months, holds up relationships of that kind, prevents them decaying through time, it turns out that the two sexes operate in very different worlds. For boys, it's doing stuff together. They literally have to get out there and bang their heads together, or whatever it is that boys do, going out in various contexts. For girls, it's talking together. And I put it to you that this explains why boys' phone calls last only 7.3 seconds on average, because all they need to do is say, "See you in the pub at 7 o'clock. After that, you don't actually have to say anything. All you have to do is sort of sit there and enjoy each other's company. Whereas for girls, it's a very vocal, verbal social world of really talking through that social complex world that they actually live in. And in order to do that, they really have to spend time face-to-face ultimately. But in the interim, when you can't be face-to-face, telephone technology is perfectly designed to support women's social worlds. It's useless for blokes, but it's wonderfully designed for a girl's social world. So in one sense, I'm going to end on a slight caricature here, but I think there's, like all caricatures, there's a nub of truth in it. And it seems to me that the social world we live in is not very far from what it was when you were about 8, if you can remember back that far. Now, for girls, the social world is incredibly intense. It's really a one-on-one relationship. When Penelope doesn't invite you to her party, this is the end of the universe as we know it. It's a major, major crisis. For boys, a relationship is standing on opposite sides of the road, kicking a football backwards and forwards. Now, I maintain that actually it doesn't matter whether it's a little boy on the other side of the road or a wall. As long as the football comes back to you, that's a relationship. I leave you with that thought.
Robin, Deborah, I'm sure that there's plenty here that you're going to enjoy discussing. Specifically, perhaps you could tackle the question, what is the relationship of language to gender?
Well, thank you. That's a very broad question, and it could be interpreted as just an invitation to try and lay it all out. But actually, I'm going to try to address the narrower question, which I think is definitely lurking in the shadows here, and which is more like the question that Professor Spalke was asked. Is it true, as so many people now assume it is, that there are so-called hardwired differences in the linguistic abilities of men and women? Are females, on average, more verbally skilled or more inclined to verbalise than males? And might that be the underlying reason why we observe so many gender differences in actual language behaviour? Now, if you haven't been living on another planet for the last 20 years, you're probably going to know what the main differences are supposed to be, and some of them have been obligingly trotted out tonight. So women talk more, attach more importance to talking. Their talk tends to be people-focused, collaborative and empathetic, whereas men treat talking either as a way of getting things done, like making an appointment to meet in the pub, or as something akin to a competitive sport. They live in Dave, the home of witty banter. Now, this is the popular Mars and Venus view. The allusion for anyone who has been on another planet is to the self-help book Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. And nowadays, that does often go along with the belief that the differences must be innate. I'm going to explain why I and most other people who study linguistic behaviour directly take a different view. The research evidence just doesn't support the most common beliefs about male-female linguistic differences, either what they actually are or how they're most convincingly explained. Now, I'm not going to suggest that there are no differences between the genders in linguistic behaviour, because on the contrary, there are many. They're just not the ones that are endlessly harped on in popular sources. So, and as an illustration, consider the belief that women talk much more than men. In 2006, a popular science book called The Female Brain went so far as to put some actual numbers on this difference, claiming that women on average utter 20,000 words a day, whereas the male average is a paltry 7,000. This statistic made headlines around the world, many of which were some variation on science finally proves the bleeding obvious. But on investigation, it turned out there was no science. The figures had been taken out of a self-help book whose author appeared to have plucked them from thin air. After this was pointed out, some researchers in Arizona decided to try and settle the argument by conducting a real word counting study. With almost 400 subjects who were recorded over several days, they found a great deal of individual variation and no significant gender difference at all. The mean for both sexes of words uttered per day was approximately 16,000. For various reasons, linguists like me don't regard counting the words uttered by somebody in a certain time period as a useful measure of group differences in talkativeness. But the Arizona findings did fit with what we already knew from quite a lot of other studies using other measures. In casual talk among equals, men and women contribute about equally. In formal situations, where status is a factor, most studies find men talking more than women. However, some studies have reported exceptions to that pattern, which suggests that the real explanation is not about gender, it's about status. Not surprisingly, in situations where status matters, high-status speakers tend to talk more than low-status speakers. And gender comes into this indirectly because in the situations in question, there's still quite a strong tendency for men to outnumber women in the high-status positions. So the exceptions I mentioned were cases where women either were the highest-ranked participants, as it happened, or the topic of conversation was something both sexes considered a female area of expertise, so that the women were deferred to by the men, which underlines an important point about real-life language use, that it's not just about how you speak, it's also about how you're heard, how you're responded to, that can allow you to dominate without you necessarily having the intention or the style to dominate. Now, I focused on the belief that women talk more than men because it's so entrenched in popular folklore. But if I had time, I could actually give the same treatment to all the generalisations I mentioned at the beginning, because none of them is supported by good research evidence. And of course, that makes it a bit pointless to argue about whether we should explain them as expressions of hardwired traits or the result of social influences or a mixture. If a difference doesn't exist, the question of its causation doesn't arise. But you might say, well, but you've already conceded there are differences. What would be wrong with explaining them as having some biological basis? Isn't there, in fact, pretty good evidence for verbal ability differences and also for differences in the way the male and female brains are organised for language? To that, my answer would be not no, but maybe. The jury is still out. Some of the very strong claims that are often made on this topic, in my view, go well beyond what the evidence currently justifies. So, for instance, some of the things that have been said, which have been presented as though they were matters of scientific consensus, are actually under dispute. A very common claim, no one's actually made it tonight, is that women's more advanced verbal skills reflect the fact that their brains are less strongly lateralised for language than men's, so women can make more use of both hemispheres for linguistic tasks. That's an argument that involves two claims, one about lateralisation and one about women having more advanced verbal skills. And as I say, both these claims are actually disputed. In each case, the issue has generated a large number of studies, which didn't all use the same design, didn't all come to the same conclusions. In that situation, what people often do is use the technique of meta-analysis, so putting the studies together and using statistical means to try and find out what the overall trend is. On lateralization, a meta-analysis published in 2008 and concluded that overall the evidence didn't support the idea that women's brains were less strongly lateralized. And on verbal skill, meta-analyses carried out in 2006 and before that in 1988 both concluded that although there is a difference, and on most measures it does favour females, it is very slight. It's either slight or close to zero, and too small to bear the weight of the stories that depend upon it. The point's also been made that this way of measuring verbal skill by using laboratory tests raises questions about what exactly subjects are displaying skill in. Are they good with language, or are they just good at tests? Also, even if they are good at language, how good a proxy is the lab test for the skills people deploy in everyday life? Now, my research isn't about doing experiments. It is about real-life verbal behaviour, so maybe I should move on to what we learn from that. In general, what we learn is that gender does have an influence on behaviour. There are patterns of linguistic variation which are clearly linked to it. But to make sense of those, there are three other things you need to know. First, the patterns I'm talking about are never cases of men behave this way and women behave that way. Most of them involve small differences in the relative frequency of a particular variant. So it's men do something a bit more, women do it a bit less, or vice versa. Second, there don't seem to be any universal patterns of gendered linguistic behaviour. What the key differences are varies significantly across cultures and over time. For example, in modern Western speech communities, it's quite a common finding that women's speech is less direct than men's, more polite, more correct in terms of grammar and pronunciation. And at one time it was thought that this might be a universal pattern. But linguistic anthropologists working in traditional non-Western societies have reported numerous cases where the pattern is the opposite. Men are the ones who use the elevated, polite, and indirect styles of language, while directness, vulgarity, and verbal aggression are female specialities. The third crucial point is that we usually find at least as much variation within each gender group as we do between the two genders. Even in a single speech community, there isn't just one way of talking which is characteristic of each sex. There's a range of ways for each, and these contrast as much with each other as with their categorical opposite. And that gives us a clue to what I am going to argue is the real explanation for most gender differences in linguistic behaviour. I say most because there isn't just one explanation for everything. But the main reason why gender does have such a strong influence is because, it relates to the way we use language to symbolise identity, to signal to others what kind of person we are, who we think we're like, and who we think we're different from. Gender is one of the aspects of identity that we put a lot of work into communicating using various symbolic means: clothes, hairstyles, gait, gesture, and of course language, which is very, very well designed for this purpose. The differences this produces are clearly not just a case of people acting out their pre-existing natures. They're a case of people actively creating distinctions which are local and culturally specific and important to them. So it's a bit like the contrasting placement of buttons on men's and women's coats, which is not dictated by the inherent structure of the garment, nor is it dictated by the bodily differences between the male and female wearers. It is basically an excess of symbolism. But the way people use language to symbolise gender is more nuanced than the way coat makers use buttons. The reason we see so much variation within genders is because gender, all on its own, is really not much of an identity at all. People don't think of themselves as generic men and women. They think of themselves as certain kinds of men and women. Women and men of different ages, classes, ethnicities, occupations, sexualities, religions. They think of themselves as ladettes or ladies, tomboys or girly girls, blokes or metrosexuals. And these local contrasts between different versions of femininity and masculinity have as much influence on linguistic behaviour as the global distinction between the two sexes, because, you know, both of those sorts of distinctions are doing the same thing. They're communicating something about who you are and who you're not. So if we're going to talk about men and women being from two different planets, we should at least actually extend the number. We should say that there might be more planets at issue than Mars and Venus. But I think the planetary metaphor is an unhelpful one in any case, because it encourages us to look at language and gender, you know, through a telescope, whereas I'm suggesting that what we really need to see anything interesting is a microscope. Like most significant relationships, the one between language and gender is complicated. There's a lot more to it than most people, including many scientists, might think.
Right, so now it's time to ask some questions. There's three microphones. If you could just raise your hand. The lights are quite bright, but I think I can see most people. And wait till a microphone arrives. There's a gentleman right at the back on the left. And we'll take a group of questions at a time to give the panellists a chance to respond to different things.
Thank you very much. I note that the two women on the panel have been defending no difference and the two men have been defending difference. That's not statistically significant, but I wonder whether it's statistically significant in some other way. Perhaps you'd be able to comment.
Good question. Any other questions? There's a lady right in the front.
Thank you very much.
If you could just wait till the microphone gets here.
That's really fantastic. Thank you very much indeed for all of those talks. I just wondered, having read The Essential Difference and also read some of Liz Spelke's work as well, I wondered what your thoughts were on specifically on Elizabeth's work on mathematics.
So did everybody get that? It just needs a little bit louder, I think.
Sorry, I asked what Simon specifically thought of Elizabeth's work on mathematics. But...
Any other questions? There's a couple of hands right in the back on the right-hand corner. Yeah, if there's a lady and then behind her there was another person.
Yeah, we've spoken about verbal linguistic differences between the sexes. What about non-verbal differences?
And there was another person in the row behind.
Hi, I'm Christella. I work at a gender identity clinic and I was wondering about... we haven't touched on that and perhaps this isn't the right... environment, but I work with people who want to transition from one gender to another, and perhaps that's more about social constructs, but there are some scientific studies that suggest some brain differences that make males, for example, want to be female at some point in their life.
Well, we've got a batch of very, very interesting questions, so maybe we'll just see if the panel wants to respond to those. Simon, did you want to take on some of those issues?
Sure. Well, first of all, I mean, the first question was entertaining, but I think probably our sample size is a bit too small to draw any conclusions. Jude asked about my take on Liz's views about no sex differences in mathematics. And Liz, I enjoyed listening to your exposition, but I think most of what you focused on was infancy. To some extent preschool, and I know that we use those terms slightly differently on each side of the Atlantic, but I think that you were talking about infants' ability or toddlers' ability to count or to estimate, which is certainly one aspect of number skills, but I'm wondering whether, just picking up on a number of comments made on the panel, that we should be looking at a range of behaviours when we're looking for possible candidates for partly biologically based differences. So there's been discussion about language and about how we use language, but actually I would pinpoint a very fundamental aspect of language, which is when children start to talk. It's a really sort of easy thing to measure. Most parents know exactly when their child said their first words, and you can also count how many words a child produces. And studies that have looked at that, both in the UK and in North America, using various checklists, when you ask parents to simply check on a list how many words does your child know and produce, show reliable sex differences, that girls talk earlier than boys, and by the age of 18 months to 2 years old, on average, the vocabulary size of girls is actually twice that of boys. So So I think, you know, it depends which aspect of behaviour you look at. That's not mathematics. That's the onset of language. And I think one of the reasons why that matters is that there are groups of children in the population who are not only delayed in terms of the other sex, potentially, but delayed in a much more clinical level of severity. Children who have specific language impairment or children who have autism. And so understanding the typical variation, including sex-linked variation in age of onset of speech and language comprehension, might also help us understand some of these medical conditions where language turns out to be an area of disability. But I think the other sort of more general point I want to pick out is that we should really be looking at behaviours which are natural, which aren't necessarily picked up when you carry out tests in laboratories, as Deborah was pointing out. So things like the amount of eye contact a child shows, how interested they are in other people. You know, these things can be picked up in more naturalistic situations using video cameras. And so it's all about which behaviours we measure.
Simon, do you want to answer the question about mathematics as well? And then Liz can come back.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we've got a real puzzle, which is that if you look at high-level mathematics, such as the level of mathematicians at universities, we do see a big difference in this, a dramatic sex ratio. It's about 75% male in most universities at that level of mathematics. So not at infancy, not at preschool, but something happened during development and during adolescence such that by the time young adults are applying to university, it's about 3/4 of applicants for mathematics are male. And that is a puzzle. You know, and that's not about counting. It's not about simple arithmetic or even estimation. And I, you know, it's an interesting discussion to be had about estimation, because people with autism like to go for the accurate number, not the estimated number. Mm. But you know, something is happening, and it needs some investigation.
Liz, can I respond?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. First, on the issue of were all of the generalizations I was making based on studies of infants? No, they're not. They're based on studies of abilities that emerge in infancy that remain present in children and that remain present in us as adults. I didn't talk about this, but in fact, when we do... For example, arithmetic problems in our heads, verbal, symbolic, arithmetic problems in our heads. We activate areas of the brain that are also active when we do the tasks that infants do as well. And if one uses various techniques to slow down or otherwise impair processes of nonverbal estimation of number, one sees corresponding impairments in adults. Verbal, symbolic, mathematical abilities. So both the abilities that I was talking about and the absence of sex differences applies across the lifetime. Now, it's true that there are natural situations in which one sees sex differences, and we've heard examples of them. The problem with these natural situations, I'm going to come out in favor of experiments, at least being conducted side by side with natural observations. The problem with these natural observations is that the behavior that someone engages in is governed by many things. It's governed by motivational factors, by one's sense of identity, by what one wants to achieve. Abilities enter in, but they are by no means the only factor or even the primary factor that determines what somebody does in some concrete situation. Mm-hmm. The thing that's nice about experiments is that you can test for different factors systematically. And that's why I actually favor experimental studies. Now, what Simon didn't say, which I sort of expected you to say, is that there are experimental tasks that show sex differences and that have been pointed to as a potential explanation for why it might be that there are more male than female engineers or scientists or mathematicians. The problem with those tasks is that what tends to happen in this discussion is that individual tasks will get focused on and get enormous attention paid to them because they show a small sex difference and therefore look like a candidate for explaining why the particular situation that obtains in our society at this moment is actually the way nature intended our society to be.
Liz, can I just interrupt? Yeah. So we're talking about small sex differences, which do occur occasionally, small ones. But when we look at, let's say, who becomes a professor of mathematics, the sex ratio is something like 14 males to one female. So those aren't small sex differences. Now, they could all be explained in terms of social models, social experience, but I think it nevertheless needs an explanation.
I agree that it needs an explanation, and I think that we should take social experience very seriously as an explanation. One reason why I say this is that back when I was a student, the sex ratio was at least as skewed, say, in medicine, as it is today in mathematics. We've seen over our lifetimes how dramatically those sex ratios can change, and how much factors of the sort that Professor Cameron was talking about, identifying with people who you see already fulfilling certain roles within the society and therefore seeing them as possible roles for yourself, can lead both to skewed distributions and also to changes over time in sex distributions.
So medicine is a great example because the sex ratio in medicine, which is a science, is now 50-50. Mm-hmm. So when the opportunity arose for women to go to university, and we should remember that that wasn't always available, my own university only started offering degrees to women in the 1930s, and some of the medical schools in the States didn't allow Jews to enter the medical schools till the 1950s. So we know that these social changes occur, but once groups are admitted into universities, we should expect to see a 50-50 ratio pretty quickly if the interests are there from both men and women.
Last word from Liz, and then we'll bring in Robin.
Actually, I'll pass. We can come back to this later.
Okay. Robin, do you want to pick up this discussion or the other questions that came up? Are you going to try the one about why the men are arguing that there are differences?
Well, I was going to sort of throw something in on that, but I think I won't, actually. It was only a question because I don't know the answer. But I thought I might just comment sort of partly in the direction of the questions back up there and partly the comments that you'd made in your talk. And that is, when we've looked at differences in conversational behaviour between men and women in small groups, they do both talk the same amount of time, that's absolutely correct. And by and large, when you look at the topics of conversation, there aren't very striking sex differences. The only striking sex difference, the only significant sex difference we had, was actually in the context of work-related things. And this was a very striking change, depending on whether there were girls present in the group or not. So, and this is actually done just up the road in at UCL. So these were all students. So, you know, the topic of interest is clearly Kant's theory of the unthinkable, which was yesterday's lecture. Well, girls sort of spend about 5% of their time talking about Kant's theory of the unthinkable, irrespective of who was present in the group. And so did boys when they were talking to boys. But if there were girls present in the group, suddenly it became the most fascinating and interesting topic in the world. And I think you pick that up. This sort of tendency for males to kind of display knowledge, and you know, that's why they want to go and fix the projector when it doesn't work for you, rather than letting the women do it who are already standing around it. They'll barge in, and it's that kind of abstract world environment which offers you a kind of basis for display. And I think the sense I get out of language anyway, we kind of perhaps look at it in a slightly different way to the way linguists do, is that women's language is much, much more social than males. Males is much more, seems, looks very much like a peacock displaying fluttering.
Well, sometimes. I mean, I have data where if you take some of the vocal information out and present people with a transcript, they think it's women and actually it's men. Mm. The men are, you know, gossiping like girls.
Yeah.
If nobody else is going to try and give an answer to the first questioner's question, perhaps I may say something about it. I would have to agree as a social scientist that the sample size is too small to generalise from. But I do feel the need to point out, to kind of say that there's a context for this discussion, and that it may not therefore be a coincidence that it's the women who are saying, actually there's not that much difference, and it's the men who are arguing for them. Because the women, the two women here, perhaps have something more personally at stake. Because this is not an argument that is in the realms of kind of scientific abstraction, and it sort of doesn't matter in the real world. You know, it does matter. It has real consequences, what stories we tell about ourselves. Because, you know, one thing I think we are as a species is a species whose behaviour can actually be affected by the ways in which we understand ourselves and our relationship to the world. So it really matters what stories we tell about sex and gender. I think, you know, not because of what biology really is in some abstract scientific way, but because of what people think it is, because of what they understand it to mean, if things are, you know, in the current popularist parlance, hardwired. They understand it to mean it's not changeable, or as Liz just said, that the way the world is now is the way it was ideally designed by nature to be. So I think there is a lot at stake, and perhaps more for women than for men. And that might be the reason, though, of course, we are dealing in anecdotage here because of the small sample size.
Let's have some more questions. Right, we've got a lot more hands, and there's quite a few in the front here. So if three rows back, there's a gentleman, and then there's a couple of hands up in the front as well.
That was all very interesting. I kind of want to go back to the very first slide that Sam Baron Cohen showed. And when basically it was said, we know there are differences between men and women physically, and there was already an assumption there. We have decided what men and women are. We will arrange our studies according to these groups. If people don't fit into how we see sex, they're not studied, they're not counted. So I'm wondering if the panel could comment about how the ways in which these studies are conducted already regulate sex and gender in society.
Thank you. And there were two hands up in the front.
Hi. So I basically come from the point of view that I think that a lot of the differences, for example, in mathematics professors might be socially determined. But I have a very specific question about grandmasters in chess, because it appears that apparently there are no female grandmasters, I heard, or very few, whereas in the sort of lower stages, there is almost equal. So I wanted to address that to you, Liz, and see if you could comment on that.
Thank you. And I think I saw another hand going up. So if you could just... Oh, sorry, yes, after you. So if the gentleman takes the question, and then there's a lady behind.
I would like to say that I think there's something quite fatiguing about this exchange. And it does seem to me it's very similar to exchanges I would have heard 20, 30 years ago about brain lateralization, for example, and the attempt to locate differences between any group of people, men, women, black, white, in genetics. Right? And I think that's the subtext here. It's the subtext.
The
differences that are being talked about, are they fundamental or are they not? And, you know, I've noticed that at age 7, which many of the curves you showed begin at age 7, I've noticed that boys and girls wear very different clothes. Do we think that's hardwired? Right? And so there's no mention of learning. And there's no mention of the power relationships that may be involved in learning. And I sense that Deborah is very exhausted by this exchange. She's been arguing this for a long time. It doesn't seem to go anywhere.
Thank you.
What is going on here?
Is there a lady second row back?
I've read an interesting article about a Swedish couple who are raising their child to be gender neutral, and the parents aren't telling anybody about whether the child is male or female in an attempt to avoid gender stereotypes. And I was just wondering if you had anything to say about that.
Any more questions? No, we seem to... Oh, yeah, there's just one in the middle.
I'm interested to know your opinions on the social... The ways that men and women differ, speaking socially, related to how emotional they may be, and how shy they may be, in connection with Professor Baron Cohen's point about men having a larger emotional part of the brain. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Deborah, are you exhausted?
Well, I was on the Today programme, so I've been up since 6 o'clock in the morning, so the literal answer to that is yes. On the Swedish couple who are trying to raise their child to be gender neutral, I'm afraid that isn't going to work, because, you know, one of the things we've put an enormous amount of emphasis on, and it always strikes me that it actually runs counter to common sense observation, is the idea that caregivers, some adult caregivers, somehow control their children's whole experience. That's really only true for a very short amount of time. You know, in linguistics, it's an absolute article of faith that it's your peers who influence you far, far more than your parents and caregivers. And, you know, the sort of evidence for that is that, I was born in Glasgow. When I first acquired language, I sounded like it. My parents moved, they still sounded the same, I didn't. Okay, so, and you know, that's a metaphor for pretty much everything about. So I think, you know, these attempts, isolated social attempts to raise children, you know, either in a non-sexist way or in a gender-neutral way, are absolutely sort of doomed to fail. However, I do think it's interesting that one of the effects, I think, of the popularity of this discourse, whose crude popular form is called brain sex, has been to kind of knock out all discussion of whether we ought to be trying different forms of parenting and socialisation and so on. That, I mean, basically the conclusion seems to be, we tried that and it failed. So we don't need to talk about it anymore, because it's all in the brain or whatever. And so, although you can't do it on your own, certainly I think you know, what your socialisation practices are does make a difference. I mean, one of the things I'd say about the studies that Simon Baron Cohen cites, it's sort of a slight methodological minutiae type point, but one of the things we can't get away from in these studies is that practically everyone who participates in them as a subject, for instance, the caregivers who are ticking the boxes for how many new words their child has uttered that day, they all know that girls are supposed to be more verbal. And they know that whether their children are girls or boys. And I think, and they talk differently to girls and boys because of beliefs about how girls and boys are. And I don't think you can rule out the possibility that that does influence what the results of those kinds of studies are. So I seem to have gone on about that. And somebody else had a question about language, which was about emotion. Is that right? I'm not sure I totally understood what you were getting at. I mean, certainly studies designed to investigate whether it's true that females are more emotionally expressive in their language than males have found that it isn't, except in one area. In big corpus studies where you look at millions and millions of words, running words that have been produced and tagged, so you can search them with a computer and look what goes with what, have interestingly found that in one area of emotional expression, and that is sort of extreme swearing, men are well ahead. So the most obscene swear words are used much more often by men. Nobody actually usually says, well, that means that men are really, really emotional. But actually, it is a form of emotional expression. Otherwise, there seems to be no difference, but I'm not sure that that's actually what you were asking about.
Deborah, apart from the Today programme, there is a serious point there, really, isn't there? I mean, do you feel rather depressed that debates and discussions that were going on 20 years ago are still going on, or indeed have even come back again?
I'm depressed by the enthusiasm with which certain kinds of models of gender have recently been embraced, because I think, you know, there was a time when the discussion, the popular discussion essentially, and, you know, especially, was more nuanced. I mean, I don't think this ever really went away, but the, you know, the time when it was possible to talk in other ways or was, you know, seems to have been very short before the status quo kind of reasserted each other. So, yes, I do think the extent to which people buy into really very simplistic forms of it is particularly depressing. Though that, you know, obviously, I don't think any sane person denies that there are biologically based differences. I've never heard any feminists say that the fact that most women can get pregnant and no men can is socially constructed. It's the meaning of it that's socially constructed. You know, what consequences it has within society. So those things are separable, but I do think we have gone back to really a very crude and simplistic way of discoursing upon this.
Robin?
I'm just going to say something very briefly, really, about on this emotional issue, because it seems to us, trying to understand the nature of relationships, to actually be the core for it. This is sort of asexual, I'm afraid. There's no gender issue in it, but it is quite an interesting issue that one of the problems we're coming up against is we actually don't know how to it's clear that relationships are emotional. That's kind of what's going on inside. We actually don't have a language to describe it. It actually makes it very... I mean, we can count up, you know, sort of emotional words used and things, but that isn't always necessarily very helpful, I think, as you've kind of indicated. The problem is we don't actually know what it is that you're feeling inside when you have these things. And it's because we don't have a very good way of turning that into language. And we can't cognize about it, and that's why we have such difficulty expressing emotional terms in language. And I think in one sense that's why we kind of appreciate poets in a way, because they actually seem to have that skill to be able to express those inner feelings in language, in a language we can all then empathize with and understand. And the problem with that is, then, if this is the case, we have no metric for measuring the quality of relationships or how we experience relationships. So we couldn't tell if there are differences in the way one sex viewed the world or the other, or indeed anybody else. You know, you're sort of in this little isolated, I'm afraid, emotional microcosm where you only get these very indirect senses of what's going on in other people's minds. And that kind of makes it very difficult for us in science to get a handle on that problem. You know, in the end, we have to. I think the answer is science has to try everything in the end. We shouldn't be stymied by apparent difficulties at the time. But it is a major problem that we're encountering in our work.
Liz, inevitably you're going to have to deal with chess.
Yes, I want to deal with chess, but I don't have a good answer for you. I think that there are some possibilities that we can rule out as to why it is that at the very highest levels you see boys and men going on to be chess masters when lots of kids are playing chess early on. So one thing we can rule out is that the basic abilities you need to be able to play chess, to track movements of objects in space, movements around the board, see ahead to further configurations and so forth, these seem to be equally available to boys and girls. Another thing that we know about chess, though, is to become really good at it, you have to practice it intensely, work on it intensely over many years, long, long periods of intense work. But there, too, I think we can rule out the idea that, in general, males are more likely to engage in that kind of intense work than females are, for two reasons. First of all, there's other occupations that also require very intense work over many years, like becoming a great musician. And there we see we don't see this skew that you see for the chess masters. Plus, when one looks across the general population and asks, how good are people at working hard for future gains, one sees that girls are at least as good as boys, and probably better on by very small amounts on some of these measures. So I'm left with the puzzle. I don't think we understand why, and I think that the study of chess is really going to need to be analyzed in the same kinds of ways that mathematical and scientific reasoning have been analyzed. Like math and science, we didn't evolve to do chess. Whatever we're doing when we do it, we're taking other abilities and we're putting them together in a new way, and I think we won't really be able to answer to understand what's involved, and therefore to understand whether there's anything inherently different about boys and girls that influences who becomes involved in it and who becomes really good at it. I think we won't be able to answer that question yet. I think possibly the cognitively most distinctive thing about us as a species is that most of what we know we learn from each other. Certainly this is true for mathematics and science. Very few of us have actually done any of the experiments whose findings inform an educated person's views of the world. These are things that we learn about in talking to other people, in reading newspapers, in going to school, in reading books. We're learning an enormous amount from other people. And this predisposition to learn from other people goes all the way back to the beginning of infancy. From the very beginning of life, infants are paying attention to other people. They're tending to analyze other people's actions so that they themselves can reproduce them. From the time children start understanding language, they're systematically taking in information from other people and evaluating other people to see who's a good witness here, whose testimony should I be trusting if different people are saying different things about the world, and so forth. So learning is very much has to be a part of the story of how we come to have cognitively the abilities that we have. I actually think that this predisposition that we have to learn from other people may partly explain why, even though we identify with people of our own gender more than others on average, we divide up the social world by gender, we differ physically by gender, and so forth, why we don't actually differ cognitively by gender. Because in order to learn from other people, you have to have cognitive common ground with them. You have to make the same assumptions that they do about the world if you're going to understand what they're communicating to you. And children who are built to learn from everybody in their immediate social group, would, I think, find themselves in a very confusing place if it turned out that their mother and their father were living on different planets and construing the world fundamentally differently and giving them incommensurable kinds of information. So I actually think that our sociality and our propensity to learn from each other could potentially help explain why, even as our interests diverge, our conceptions of the world and our cognitive abilities seem to stay in line with one another. But one very last point. I do think that in your question, you set up a dichotomy that's not helpful. A dichotomy that says either something's learned or it has some biological basis. I actually think we're a species that's biologically predisposed to learn. And that if we want to understand how we are able to develop the encyclopedic knowledge that members of any given culture have, we have to look at those biological abilities as well as the environment in which they express themselves.
Liz, I just wanted to ask you, because as I understand it, you weren't really looking at sex differences in your work
right.
at all until Larry Sumner provoked the controversy in 2005, and you sort of rose to the challenge. I mean, do you find this debate actually a little tiresome?
I'm having fun tonight, so maybe not.
That's fine.
So maybe not. It's true that I didn't set out to study sex differences, and throughout most of my work, I thought the question was fairly boring because the answer was always no. There is no evidence for this in the studies that we're doing. But actually, the more I think about it, I think, look, with all of the manifest differences on the surface in the ways that men and women behave and the roles that they play and so forth, it's kind of interesting that we're so alike cognitively. So I do think that's an interesting question.
Great. Simon.
So lots of great questions tonight, and I've enjoyed listening to the answers on the panel. First of all, on the question of a parent trying to raise their child in a gender-neutral way, I was interested by what Robin was saying about monkeys and other primates and this sex difference that emerges in what he called rough and tumble play. And, you know, I'd be very interested to know what happens to this child who's not told if they're male or female in terms of the style of play, because that's certainly something that you see across a range of primate species, but we also see it in human primates too, that boys are more likely to engage in more of this rough and tumble play. And it's just an interesting question of where it comes from. Then we had this question about grandmasters in chess. And I do think that's a really interesting one, because unlike the kinds of studies that Liz was describing, where we're looking at, say, mathematical abilities in early childhood, using the sort of simple building blocks in mathematics, when you're looking at the other extreme, the people who become grandmasters in chess or who get the equivalent of the Nobel Prize in mathematics, which is the Fields Medal. I don't believe there's been a single female winner of the Fields Medal in the history of the medal. I was interested to hear about the absence of women in grandmaster chess. And what I'm reminded of is an observation by one of Liz's colleagues at Harvard, Steve Pinker, because he talks about the very small differences you see in the middle of the distribution when you're comparing means, that males and females can be very close to each other, and as a result you see very small, if any, sex differences. But when you go out to the extremes, when you look at individuals who either excel or have difficulties, you might see very skewed or much more marked differences. And he describes this as a function of the normal distribution. So if I can just illustrate what I'm talking about, if we took height, we know that males and females only differ by a small amount if you compare the means. You remember it was about 6 inches between the average male and average female. That's at the mean or the middle of the distribution. But when you go to the extremes, and let's take extremely tall people, at 5'8", Steve Pinker points out, the sex ratio is 30 males to 1 female. Now, if you go 2 more inches along that dimension to 6 foot, the sex ratio becomes 2,000 males to 1 female. So the point he makes is it's to do with the way that the normal distribution drops off and what happens when you have a small difference in the middle of the distribution, how those differences can be exaggerated in the tails of the distribution. And, part of what we have to understand is why we see these very dramatic sex ratios in both medical conditions like autism, where the sex ratio can be biased towards boys, why we might see some very distorted sex ratios in occupations like higher mathematics or higher chess playing. And to me, these have some interesting connections, because what happens in autism is that the person doesn't learn from others, whereas most of us are paying a lot of attention to faces and to what other people are doing. The person with autism tends to figure things out on their own in a solitary way. They learn things almost, by themselves. When the mathematician who cracked Fermat's last theorem, worked on that problem, he didn't come into the maths faculty in Cambridge. He stayed at home, and he worked for 7 years in isolation until he arrived at the math faculty to present his solution to a mathematical problem. And to me, this is about some minds being very oriented towards being sociable and other minds being very oriented towards being motivated to solving a problem on their own, figuring things out on their own. And, we need to make space for that diversity of learning styles that sometimes developmental psychology tends to assume that children all develop in the same way. But there are going to be some kids who enter the classroom in a less sociable way and others who enter the classroom in a much more sociable way. And that is part of the diversity of human beings. The last point I want to make is whether this debate is getting tired. And I would say that, 40 years ago, if we thought about debates about gender, we did have very dichotomous conversations, that it was all about learning and that the biologists were the bad guys. In fact, sociobiologists were equated with being some form of fascism, where, a biological approach to gender was going to foreclose any possibility of change in society. And I think what has changed over 40 years is actually that We've had the Human Genome Project. We can no longer deny the importance of genetics, but no one wants to discount the importance of learning. Both of them are equally important. And what I'd like to see in today's debate, you know, 21st century, is a recognition that both contribute to human behaviour, whether we're talking about gender or any of our other behaviours.
Thank you very much, Simon. I'm sure you all agree with me. It's been an absolutely fascinating conversation. Before I just ask us to express our appreciation, I just want to draw your attention to the fact that there's another debate in this series on the 1st of December, same place, same time, Transitioning Gender, the Challenges of Radial Technologies. And I think there was a question on transgender which came up at the back, which I'm afraid the panel didn't address. So perhaps at that debate, that will be something that can be addressed. In the meantime, I'm sure you will join me in a round of applause for a wonderful conversation.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.